Now to introduce today's speaker, Dr. Robert Morris. We're so lucky to have him. I first found out about him, I was in a meeting with the provost, and it was with a bunch of deans, and the dean of the School of Public Health, Pat Wall, came to the meeting holding this book. And she said, Ann, you have to read this book, you have to read this book. And so I borrowed it, and as soon as I borrowed it, I got off Amazon.com, and I stayed up all night and read it. It is a great book. It's called The Blue Death by Robert Morris, and you can get it off Amazon also. He's an environmental epidemiologist and a leading researcher in the area of drinking water and health. He received his PhD in environmental engineering from the University of Wisconsin and also received his MD at the Medical College of Wisconsin. He has taught at the Tufts University School of Medicine, the Harvard School of Public Health, and at the Medical College of Wisconsin as well. He's served as the advisor to the Environmental Protection Agency, the Centers for Disease Control, the National Institutes of Health, and the President's Cancer Panel. He's been featured in the New York Times and the London Times, and also on Dateline, NBC, and BBC. And we're fortunate that he lives here in Seattle, Washington, too. With that, let's offer a warm, enthusiastic welcome to Dr. Robert Morris.
Thank you, Ann. Really delighted to be here. I'd like to hear those policies. It means I truly have a captive audience. It's also nice. Drinking water's been in the news lately. All this talk about drugs and drinking water. We're fortunate to have our water coming from a nice, pristine reservoir in the Cascades. But you know, after a winter like this, I start thinking maybe just a little bit of Prozac in the water wouldn't be such a bad thing. As Ann said, I've been doing research in drinking water for a long time, and I watched a lot of studies come out about drinking water and health and problems with our water supply. The conversation seemed to be limited to a relatively small circle of scientists, engineers, the occasional bureaucrat or politician, and I really wanted to expand that audience, and that's why I wrote the book. It wasn't just that I thought a book about drinking water and diarrhea would be a perfect summer blockbuster. So the story of modern drinking water really begins in 1848 when a young physician by the name of John Snow dug into his savings and published a monograph that should have changed the world. England was in the grip of a horrifying cholera epidemic. Thousands of people were dying, and he put forth the radical concept that drinking water could be spreading disease. And nobody believed him. Nobody believed that something that you couldn't see, that you couldn't smell, something that you could hide in a glass of water could kill you. And so I spend a long time with Snow because this is sort of a classic question of why was it these people didn't believe him? Because these were the smartest minds of the time and they just didn't buy it. And really, if you look at it, it's another story of an inconvenient truth at odds with money and old ways of thinking. So it's a very familiar story and sort of a classic one. This is the Blue Death. The Blue Death was what they called cholera because the strange thing about waterborne diseases is that they tend to dehydrate you. That's how they kill you. They dry you out, and your blood gets so thick that in the case of cholera, you can't get oxygen to your tissues, and you turn blue, and you die. And you die in a matter of hours after you get the disease. It's a devastating disease. This guy is the other key protagonist in the story of drinking water in 19th century London. The guy with the fabulous swoosh is named Edwin Chadwick, and he was not a scientist by training, but he was a very powerful politician, and he was convinced that all smell is disease. You have to remember that London at the time sat upon some over 100,000 cesspools, and that you couldn't connect household plumbing to the sewers. The sewers were for draining the streets. And Chadwick had the idea that you could, if you could just get all the waste out of where people were living and eliminate the odors that were just horrific in the day, you would eliminate epidemic diseases, including cholera. And this invention was a key part of his plan. This is the toilet. And my favorite part of this picture is this early example of PR. They've got little fish swimming up here in the water tank. But the toilet was actually invented. The water closet was invented in the 17th century, but nobody used it because nobody could figure out what to do with all the water that came out. You couldn't fill up your cesspool with that, and there was nothing to do with it. And Chadwick thought, look, we'll just connect all these houses to the sewers and drain the streets, clean up the houses, and everybody's going to be better off. There were two problems with that. One, the only place that the water could go was the River Thames. And the second problem was that happened to be the primary source of drinking water for the city of London. So Chadwick almost had it right, but he didn't quite have it right. And I just want to, I hate it when I go to hear a talk and somebody starts reading their talk. But, I wrote a book, so I figure I get a pass on that. So I'm gonna read a little bit here. And just to give you a sense of what it was like, homes throughout the neighborhood had spent a night in sheer terror as family members plummeted into the abyss of cholera. On the morning of Friday, September 1st, as the people of Soho stepped outside, they found that a cooling breeze had arrived from the northeast. The heat wave had faded, but something far worse had arrived in the dark of night. Word of the horror buzzed through the neighborhood. Almost everyone, it seemed, knew someone who was dying. No one understood the scope of the disaster better than Reverend Henry Whitehead, the priest at St. Luke's Church, which stood just one block from Broad Street. Throughout the previous evening and into the night, he had walked the streets of his parish in long, flowing robes, ministering to the afflicted and their families. For many, the appearance of his broad, smiling face gave them a moment of reassurance in an otherwise desperate night. When he finally made his way home through the dense mix of mist and coal smoke to the small apartment that he shared with his brother, he sensed he was facing a devil unlike any he had encountered in his 29 years. He would spend much of the next day delivering last rites to the dying. Word of the tragedy had yet to reach the affluent district just across Regent Street, where John Snow had immersed himself in a study of the London water supply. His office was filled with maps, death records, and the data he had assembled over the preceding year. After 6 years of struggling to convince the medical establishment that drinking water could spread cholera, John Snow felt he was finally closing in on the proof that might muffle his critics. The ground itself would need to shake to divert his attention from the task at hand. But as the sun rose on that Friday morning, John Snow had no notion of the horrifying turn of events so close to the desk where he sat piecing together the story of the London water supply. He could not see the first black windowless carriage as it appeared from behind the curtain of fog that the cool air had draped across Broad Street. He could not hear the horses protest as their driver, also dressed in black, pulled at the reins, bringing the carriage to a stop in front of a four-story building. Two men climbed down and entered the front door with a stretcher. They climbed to an apartment marked by a row of shuttered windows. Minutes later, they emerged, carrying a draped, lifeless figure. Before they had finished loading the corpse into the back of their carriage, the sound of hoofbeats and steel-rimmed wheels signaled the arrival of another crew with the same grim mission. Over the course of that day, a fleet of hearses rolled steadily through the district. Again and again, these faceless wagons came to collect their tragic cargo. More than 60 people living in the area around Broad Street died on that Friday. As each hearse arrived, neighbors watched, quietly registering the address of the deceased and wondering where the next would stop. This is Broad Street. And this is the famous pump. I don't know how many of you know the story of the Broad Street pump, but John Snow, who had been living in London, had written his monograph, had not been believed, and was working on what he thought was the final proof on a study, a fabulous study that he conducted on the other side of the Thames, came to investigate. Because he was the one person in London who kind of had an idea of what was going on, and he headed for this pump, and he tested it. He couldn't prove anything. He had no idea what bacteria even was at the time. But he convinced the local authorities to remove the handle of the pump. There are actually several myths I want to explode for you about John Snow before I move on. One is that removing the handle of the pump actually stopped the outbreak, because by the time they took the handle off, not only had most of the people who were going to be infected become infected, but the rest of them had packed up and left because it was just scary to be around. And if you can imagine what it's like when people are dying all around you and you have no idea what's causing it, your instinct is to just leave town, and that's what people did. But he drew up this famous map. And in this famous map, at the center there is the pump. Let's see. Right there is the pump. And each one of these little black marks is somebody who died. And you look at this and think, today, with today's insight, you can look at that map and say, oh, gosh, the pump must have been contaminated. But, in fact, most people didn't find that too compelling at the time. And the second myth about this is actually that this was not very good epidemiology. It's a lovely map, and it's very compelling. But John Snow didn't really calculate what you needed to know to prove that the pump was responsible, which is to look at the people around here and look at people who got sick and see how many of them drank from the pump, and then look at people who didn't get sick and see what proportion of them drank from the pump, and then you might have some insight into what caused the outbreak. He just showed that most of the people that got sick drank from the pump. In fact, this is the guy who did the real compelling study about the Broad Street pump. This is Henry Whitehead, the priest. And he at first said, there's no way the pump was responsible. He was convinced that Snow was completely wrong. In fact, wrote a little monograph of his own saying that the pump had not been responsible. I suspect part of the reason for that is that he had drunk water from the pump, but I think he probably was discounting the fact that he was mixing that water with copious quantities of brandy, which probably did in the bacteria. But he was a remarkable guy because he really came to admire John Snow. In fact, a picture of John Snow hung in his office until his death. And he looked at what Snow was doing on the other side of the river, where he was really doing fabulous epidemiology. I mean, Snow really invented epidemiology just to prove his point. And Chad and Whitehead looked at what he was doing and said, well, I can do that. And he did it around the pump to prove that Snow was wrong and end up convincing himself that Snow was absolutely right, that the pump was responsible. The third myth is, okay, that Snow came in, he looks at the pump, and everybody sees this is the wise thing to clean up the drinking water and we should do something about it, because the water in London did not improve demonstrably after Snow did his study. He was starting to convince people, but Chadwick held sway over what was happening in London with the water. In fact, the way you convince people that there is to make radical changes is not always science. In fact, it's often not science. And in fact, what convinced people in London was in the summer of 1858, there was a horrible drought. It was a long, hot summer. And the Thames River became essentially a great sloshing cesspool, and nobody could get anywhere near it. But unfortunately for the members of Parliament, they happened to be relatively close to the river. And they would go and hide in the back rooms with scented handkerchiefs. And remarkably enough, after the year of the... I mean, this is literally the first time that I'm aware of that, or perhaps the only time in history that an odor earned itself a proper name. So they authorized a massive construction project, the biggest construction project at the time in the history of England, to build these huge pipes 14 miles downstream and make the waste of London somebody else's problem. And in fact, London was spared the next time cholera hit Europe. This is Robert Cook. The other thing is that the other myth about Snow is that he, his science held sway. I mean, really, Snow was, in a way, rediscovered in the 19th, in the 20th century when people went back and looked at things. But the way people looked at water and disease did not change dramatically until about 30 years later, when Koch and Pasteur started zeroing in on the causes of cholera. And it was an epic battle between these two guys who really founded microbiology. And the two of them went first to Egypt to try to find, well, actually it was a team of Pasteur's. Pasteur was too sick to make it, but they chased cholera to Egypt and then to India and tracked it down and found this bacteria and demonstrated, and in fact had to go back to epidemiology to demonstrate that cholera, this organism was responsible for cholera. And even then, even after Koch isolated the organism in the laboratory, the powers that be resisted the idea. In the 1890s, Chadwick, to his deathbed, did not believe that drinking water was really spreading cholera. And this guy, Pettenkofer, was the German equivalent of Chadwick, although he was in fact a scientist, a public health scientist. And I want to just read you what I consider sort of a telling story. In 1893, Robert Koch's laboratory in Berlin received a strange request. Professor Max von Pettenkofer, director of the Institute of Hygiene in Munich, wanted some cholera. The fact that he wanted cholera was not remarkable. Koch's lab had maintained a culture of Vibrio cholera since the outbreak in Hamburg and may have been the only source of the bacteria in Germany. Anyone wanting to study the cholera would need a sample. The thing that made this request stand out was that Pettenkofer had no plans to study the microbe in his own laboratory. He was convinced that the bacteria growing in Koch's culture media did not cause cholera and saw no need to study it further. He did, however, have an experiment in mind. Despite the fact that Pettenkofer was a leading critic of Koch, George Gafke, one of Koch's colleagues, prepared a sample to send. Pettenkofer was, after all, the elder statesman of public health in Germany. Gafke packaged the sample with exceptional care and sent it to Munich. The sealed vial within contained enough Vibrio cholera to kill hundreds of people. At 74, Pettenkofer was one of Germany's most senior scientists, with former students in key positions throughout the country. Pettenkofer was convinced that cholera in drinking water could not by itself cause the disease. Soon after receiving the sample, Pettenkofer stood before a small audience in a lecture hall in his institute. He explained to them his long-held belief that agents released from damp soils were the real cause of cholera. Koch's comma-shaped bacteria might predispose one to the disease, he told them, but in absence of the appropriate atmospheric and hygienic conditions, it was harmless. Then he held up the vial containing billions of the bacteria and told the audience that he was now prepared to offer definitive proof of his theory. He then put the flask to his lips, tilted his head back, and consumed its contents. I mean, that's putting your money where your mouth where your money is or whatever. I'm not going to tell you what happened. I don't want to spoil the ending there. But it's not exactly, you know, telling you the fate of Harry Potter to tell you that Snow and Koch's ideas did finally carry the day, and that ultimately convinced water suppliers in cities around the world that they better find a clean source of water. And people worked on filtration, they developed reservoirs, they developed water supplies, but they still were having horrible problems with typhoid. And one contractor built a water supply in New Jersey, but people were getting typhoid, and the city didn't want to pay for the reservoir. In order to get paid, he had an idea. He called in an expert who had recently used chlorine to protect cattle at the stockyards in Chicago. And he decided that if it was good enough for the cows in Chicago, it was good enough for the people in New Jersey. And so they started bubbling chlorine gas into the reservoir, into the water supply. Oops. And there's two ringing phrases here. One, that so successful has been this experiment, is that any municipal water plant, no matter how large, can be made as pure as mountain spring water. The chlorine, it is said, destroys all animal and microbe life in a great body of water, leaving no trace of itself afterward. It is placed in a tank in the reservoir and infused into the water through a spray. This might seem a little naive to our eyes today, but at the time, when people were dying from horrible waterborne diseases all around, this was, you know, clean is a moving target. And from that perspective, this was as clean as mountain spring water. And the impact of widespread water purification is pretty dramatic. If you look at waterborne diseases, the deaths from waterborne diseases, this is case fatality rates. Okay, that's the percentage of people who died. And in 1920, and so that's even, this was 1908 that chlorine was introduced, and in 1920 it had dropped off dramatically. Starting in 1920, case fatality rates from waterborne disease dropped off dramatically. The rates of waterborne diseases dropped. I think what's happening here is people are starting to look at other diseases as being waterborne, viral diseases and parasitic diseases. So everything looked like problem solved. If you were looking at drinking water in the middle of the 20th century, 1950s, 1960s, there wasn't much more to do. Okay, we just had to keep filtering, adding chlorine. But then some issues started to emerge. One was the growing recognition that maybe those trace quantities of chemicals weren't necessarily so harmless. I mean, this is sort of better living through chemistry, that people would be doing this at home, testing their chlorine gas at home. But in fact, in the 1970s, chemists started to realize that the chlorine that was being added to drinking water was combining with organic matter in the water and forming a whole raft of products, among them chloroform, which was a known carcinogen. And they started to get worried, although they worried very quietly about it. The EPA sat on this story for years before a reporter stumbled on it in the Dutch medical literature. And once that was realized, there was a tremendous flurry of activity, and this is the kind of stuff that epidemiologists jump on. You know, other people's misfortune is basically the fodder for epidemiology. You sort of have to wait till bad things happen and then try to figure out what happened, and this was looked like kind of a bad thing. And so there were a number of epidemiologic studies, and this is a graph from a study that I did in the 90s, and each of these lines represents an epidemiologic study, and each of these little lines here is a relative risk. I don't know if you know what a relative risk is, but it's the rate of disease among people who are exposed compared to the rate of disease among people who are not exposed. And if you look, they tend to define elevated risks of bladder cancer among people who had lifetime exposure to chlorinated surface water supplies. But the numbers, the risks were all over the map, and the confidence intervals tended to be huge. And so In 1991, the International Agency for Research on Cancer looked at these and said, well, we really can't figure out what's going on. We can't even call it a possible risk of cancer. And I did a study where I combined these and looked at them all together. And when you combine them, it becomes pretty convincing that there is an elevated risk of bladder cancer related to chlorination byproducts. The other piece of this story that emerged in the second half of the 20th century is the fact that maybe the beast wasn't dead yet. We had improved the quality of our water, but waterborne disease was not exactly finished. So in 1993, this was the front page of the Milwaukee Sentinel. And there was schools started to close on a particular Monday morning because they couldn't find enough teachers. And the pharmacies were running out of Imodium. That was the news story, actually began with the pharmacies running out of Imodium. And then on Monday morning, schools started to close. And people were wondering what the heck was going on. And nobody could really figure it out. I'll read one more excerpt here. If the battle against this outbreak had become a war, Dr. Taft had become one of the commanders in the ground campaign. He had been called to see more and more patients who were suffering from the mysterious infection. Taft had enough experience he could often identify an organism just by the pattern of signs and symptoms in his patients. But so far, the pathogen had not shown its hand. Then, as he stood waiting for an elevator, another physician pulled him aside. Taft's colleague was caring for a woman with severe diarrhea in the hospital's intensive care unit. In a tissue sample from the lining of her small intestine, he had found what looked like cryptosporidium. Now, finding a cryptosporidium by itself would not have been unusual. It often appeared as the cause of severe diarrhea in people with AIDS. Even the fact that it had put this woman in the ICU was not extraordinary, except for one thing. She did not have AIDS. As soon as he could, Taft made his way to the ICU to see the woman himself. In a hospital, the intensive care unit defines a special territory where death holds watch, as modern medicine wields all of its technical muscle in defiance. Like all physicians, he had learned to approach the ICU with a calm remove that allowed him to focus on the intellectual challenge of saving lives. As he entered the woman's room, a pale yellow line traced the echo of her heartbeat on a monitor above her head. He gazed down at her frail body and examined her sunken features. A pump droned in the background as it steadily pushed saline through a catheter and into the veins of her withered arm. That pump was keeping her alive. He lifted her hand and took her twisted fingers in his own. Years of the slow and ultimately losing struggle against rheumatoid arthritis had contorted them at a tortured angle. Her skin had turned thin and paper-like from the side effects of the drugs used to treat her arthritis, drugs that also suppressed her immune system. The fact that this woman was overrun with cryptosporidium seemed unusual. The drugs she was taking for arthritis had weakened her immune system, but not to the extent that AIDS would. Nonetheless, Taft knew that strange things happen in medicine. He was considering the possibility that this was nothing more than an interesting case when his pager went off. He recognized the number as the microbiology laboratory. And that's what the microbiology laboratory was finding. This is cryptosporidium oocysts on the lining of the human intestine. Actually, I don't think that's a human intestine. I think that's an animal intestine. And these are the organisms emerging from the eggs. And cryptosporidium turned out to be the cause of the outbreak, and the scale of the outbreak was staggering. 400,000 people got sick, 4,000 were hospitalized, and over 100 people died. By those numbers, the largest outbreak in U.S. history to be recognized as waterborne. And according to the CDC, we almost missed even recognizing that this was a waterborne outbreak. It really was the astute work of a few people that made the difference in whether or not this would be recognized, because we have no really active surveillance system for waterborne disease in the United States. Essentially, the CDC sits down in Atlanta and waits for a phone call. That's surveillance. And that's really what it amounts to. And if there's a phone call, they'll go up and investigate. And they're pretty good at tracking things down, but the surveillance was really designed for a time when they were worried about typhoid and cholera, and those were diseases that tended to get diagnosed pretty easily. So the bottom line is we have serious problems with our water supply in the United States. It's an aging system. In 2005, a radical fringe group known as the American Society for Civil Engineers put out a report card on America's infrastructure, and they gave drinking water and wastewater a grade of D-. Okay. And my feeling is that if we don't do something, part of my reason for writing this book is that if we don't do something about that, we're going to wind up with a failing grade. And drinking water just isn't an issue that seems to light a lot of political fires. I mean, I can't think of anyone who's ever been elected on a platform of suggesting that they will tear up your streets and spend your money to repair leaking water mains. But in fact, most major cities, the water mains leak so badly that as much as 30% or more of the water going into those pipes is actually just leaking into the ground. In fact, it's in New Orleans that's so bad now after Katrina that the viability of the city is really somewhat in question just because the water mains are completely shredded. But that's not atypical. Okay. So we have problems in the United States and in the developed world, but really that's no comparison to the story of the developing world, where drinking water today will kill roughly 6,000 people who don't have access to clean water. It's really a humanitarian crisis of epic proportions. And I believe if we ignore it, that disaster is going to find its way back to us, because those organisms are evolving, those organisms are changing, and those organisms can appear in the United States, and don't kid yourself that they can't. To give you a sense of this, this is a picture from Goma, which experienced, to my knowledge, the worst waterborne outbreak ever anywhere. As the sun rose over Zaire, a lone cargo helicopter lumbered through the shadows of the Virunga Mountains. Ahead, past the steaming summit of the Nyiragongo volcano, was Lake Kivu, the highest lake in Africa. In the 19th century, vacationing colonists had flocked to the shores of this beautiful mountain lake for a respite from the busy work of exploiting the region's natural wealth. In the summer of 1994, its deep blue waters gave rise to the worst outbreak of waterborne disease in human history, an epidemiological perfect storm. Inside the helicopter, Les Roberts, an epidemiologist for the World Health Organization, peered out at the lush jungle that clung to the mountainside. Beyond the mountains, Rwanda stretched out toward the sunrise. Ahead, on the ancient lava flow that separated the mountains from the lake, the city of Goma seemed to be under siege, surrounded by the makeshift shelters of hundreds of thousands of refugees. Just 2 months earlier, Dr. Roberts had been in Atlanta, completing his training as an epidemiologist with the Centers for Disease Control. Now he was flying to the heart of a surreal world ruled by death and disease. He had been working with the WHO to monitor the epidemic and knew the statistics as well as anyone, but they could only hint at the reality on the ground. The scale of the epidemic in Goma and the speed with which it was unfolding stunned even the most seasoned veterans with experience in refugee camps throughout the world. A red-haired cork bobbing on a dark-skinned African ocean, Dr. Roberts made his way from the airport to the command and control center of the United Nations High Commission on Refugees UNHCR in Goma. Officials there directed him to the medical facilities of Médecins du Monde in the Muganga camp, one of the three camps around Goma. As his motorcycle taxi entered the camp and rattled slowly across the sea of human misery, Les Roberts began to grasp the unique horror of Goma. Along the two-mile road from the airport, hundreds of corpses, sometimes stacked two or three high, awaited pickup by workers in the camp. The dead were not the victims of Tutsi soldiers. A far more ruthless predator had been waiting for the Hutus as they arrived in Goma. Long before the coming of the Rwandans, a microscopic killer found its refuge amid the poverty of Zaire. For years, it had moved slowly from one Zairean to the next, leaving a trail of disease behind. The sudden appearance of the refugees, exhausted, malnourished, and thirsty from their flight, presented this killer with a rare opportunity. Within days of their arrival, an explosion of cholera had begun to consume the refugees. On reaching Muganga, Dr. Roberts went directly to the MDM Cholera Treatment Center. After 2 months of compiling the death toll from the unfolding disaster in Rwanda, he would finally have a chance to intervene. The faceless numbers had not prepared him for what he found. More than 1,000 cholera victims were crammed into an open area the size of a baseball diamond. Every 5 minutes, one of them would die. Desperate workers moved among the diseased, trying to help those that could be saved with the meager and entirely inadequate resources at hand. So, in closing, I feel in this country, we can't wait for bridges to collapse and levees to fail before we do something about our infrastructure. We can't wait for the next waterborne disaster before we decide that safe water is important. We can't experiment on ourselves and our children by accepting the presence of toxic chemicals in our water supply. And we cannot allow dirty water to take a life every 14 seconds in the developing world because our attention is elsewhere. There is not just one inconvenient truth about what we are doing to our environment. There are many. The story of drinking water is one of them. So thank you for your time, and I'd be delighted to answer questions.
What's the fatality rate for cholera?
If it's, it's a moving target, because if you don't know how to treat it, the fatality rate can be as high as 50%. If it's treated properly, it's less than 10%, and some say you can get it down to 5%. And really proper treatment can be nothing more than oral rehydration, and that you have water with salts, because what's killing you is you're losing water and you just drink more. But with proper salts and things added. And if it's done right, you can. It's a tremendously effective tool and dramatically change the impact of cholera when it's managed properly in the developing world. Yes?
What water do you drink at home?
Can I plead the fifth on that? No, I just have a filter under my sink. I drink Seattle tap water, but... I find it's, if nothing else, it tastes better when I filter. But, Seattle, as I said, has these fabulous protected reservoirs in the Cascades, but they add chlorine. They have pipes that are old, like any other city, and the piping systems. It's going to cost. Probably the worst thing about our water supply at this point is the buried pipes. The pipes are as much as... it's going to cost us over the next 20 years about $100 billion to replace pipes, and over 40 years, the estimate is closer to $1 trillion just to replace water pipes. That's the state of the pipes. And these pipes are often 100 years old, and so it's a tremendous job to replace them, as anybody knows. You've got to dig up, tear up streets. So, given all that, I filter the water.
Yeah. How about water extracted from wells around the Pacific Northwest? Like, I live in the island,
yeah.
It's a real closed system.
I mean, water ultimately is a very local issue, and well water can be the best water, or it can be some of the worst water, depending on the local geology, depending on how intact the well is. You know, this, I believe this outbreak in Colorado was, that was well water. So it really depends on the quality of the well, the quality of the water supply, the depth of the well. The nice thing about groundwater is if we're good about it and protect it, and it starts out clean, it should stay clean. So,
yeah. What do you imagine an adequate monitoring system would be like?
For waterborne disease?
For waterborne disease, yeah. In the developed world.
In the developed world? You know, active surveillance. This is what's called passive surveillance. You sit around and wait. Active surveillance would mean you would have systems in place where you would be testing a certain proportion of cases in cities for diseases that might be waterborne. You would be more aggressively testing the water. But, you know, I rather than spending lots of money on active surveillance, I'd rather see more money being spent on cleaner water. You know, there's lots of ways you could go about that to improve that system, from either 10,000 feet monitoring the rates of admissions to emergency rooms for gastroenteritis to actually doing more testing of the cases that do come in to look for possible what diseases that are possibly waterborne to better testing of the water itself.
Given the magnitude of the problem, what can people actually do? Where do you start?
I think it starts by asking questions locally. I mean, I think drinking water is a very local issue. And my feeling is Seattle should work on being a model for what a water supply can and should be. And I think that's entirely possible to do, especially given that we have a relatively clean supply of source water. I would say you work on what people can do is working with local politicians to address the problem locally. I think we need to hear more people talking about something as dull as infrastructure because it's important stuff. And we need to insist that our politicians don't dodge that. And, you know, it might not be bad to stop spending money on some other things that I'm not going to mention because it's outside my purview, but there's a lot of, you know, there's plenty of money out there. We know that. It's just not being spent the right way. Other questions?
How do biological threats compare with chemical threats?
For drinking water? Mm-hmm. I think biological threats are generally more dangerous just because they, tends to be have more effect in smaller quantities. And I think most chemical threats you would have to put much more in to have an impact than the amount of organisms that you would have to put in. Yeah. It's a good question. Fluoride. What about fluoride? Clearly, in high quantities, fluoride is not a good thing to have in water. There's some question about how high is safe. On the other hand, I constantly run into panicked dentists who worry about the impact of not having fluoride in the water because they've seen what teeth are like in areas that don't fluoridate. So it's a terrific public health intervention, I think it bears some more scrutiny. I think we have to look very carefully at how much we add and whether there's other ways to get that fluoride to people in areas that have low fluoride water naturally.
Thank you.